level of meditation where that insight is not simply a philosophical or an abstract understanding, but where there's direct insight that that is the nature of things, is really what some people would call deep ecological realization, self-realization, as talked about by deep ecologists in the environmental movement. And again, that's to see directly for oneself that this is the web we live in, and that one is not separate from all other beings, that one is in kinship with all beings. Seeing that we're all connected directly in an experiential fashion comes naturally, compassion and ethics.
The fragile condition of the planet in the 20th century has given new currency to the core of Buddhist teachings. It's clear that the survival of all living things depends on our recognition of equality and interdependence.
If we are interdependent with everything and everyone else, even our smallest, least significant thought, word, and action have real consequences throughout the universe. Throw a pebble into a pond, it sends a shiver across the surface of the water. Ripples merge into one another and create new ones. Everything is inextricably interrelated. We come to realize that we are responsible for everything we do, say, or think. Responsible, in fact, for ourselves and everyone and everything else in the entire universe. As Dalai Lama said, in today's highly interdependent world, individuals and nations can no longer solve or no longer resolve many of their problems by themselves. We need one another, and we must therefore develop a sense of universal responsibility. It is a collective and individual responsibility to protect and nurture the global family, to support its weaker members, and to preserve and tend to the environment in which we live.
In recent years, participation in social and political activity has come to be seen by some Buddhists as an extension of spiritual practice. American Buddhists have adopted and in many ways inspired this approach. They are represented in disproportionate numbers in environmental, peace, and social justice movements. Organizations like the Buddhist Peace Fellowship and Thich Nhat Hanh's Order of Interbeing are growing in size and consequence.
In recent years, I've been very much engaged with the practice of Thich Nhat Hanh and the Tiaphien Order.
Buddhist Christopher Reed teaches yoga and meditation.
So I think it's very interesting in these times right now, when clearly we're facing crisis, that Buddhism is able to provide a context, an approach, a support in coming to a real engagement in the world. So as Thich Nhat Hanh says, in order to take care of the environment, we really need to take care of the environmentalists or the lawyers in social work or the peace activists or whomever it might be.
Buddhism has had wondrous effects on the consciousness of Americans. I think particularly we see it in the concerns of environmentalists. I think anyone who practices deep ecology, not just the picking up of cans and paper and storing it, but seeing, understanding how even that can is so much connected with the whole world, you know, the tin that's put in that can, or what the great suffering that's comes from the mines, and the fact that one soda can saves I don't know how many watt hours of electricity or power to make, how it's connected to every form of life in this world. I think it's this type of depth in our social movements that's very much affected by Buddhism. I think if we talk to many of the leaders, they have read something, been in contact with some Buddhist influence. Nowadays, if you look at television, educational TV, you find the words of Buddhism very much not only in religious-oriented programs, but also sociologists, psychologists, all talking about karma and interdependence and so on. And they've all read books by Watts and by Snyder.
Mm-hmm. There are going to be huge economic dislocations, I suspect.
Joanna Macy is one of the clearest voices of the American Buddhist activist community. She's a professor of philosophy and religion and travels around the world leading workshops on peace and environmental issues.
There's going to be failure and collapse of economic and financial institutions. And as we approach the end of the second millennium, as we get near to the year 2000, there's going to be a lot of temptation to go to social hysteria, to panic. When we're scared, we get mean. We need to prepare now not to have that happen. We need to start now to build the trust, to build the networks, to find the language, to build the cooperatives, the collaboration, so that this does not happen. And the tools for this, the teachings for this, come both from the Dharma and from ecology.
The growing involvement of Buddhists in social action is seen by many as a natural outgrowth of the teaching's emphasis on basic ethical practices, unselfishness, compassion, goodwill towards all beings.
All Buddhist traditions, on a fundamental level, speak of the importance of virtue, of not harming through speech, through action, through livelihood. Of having the actions of our life represent the wakefulness and compassion of a Buddha in every moment. Traditionally, these are taught as precepts to follow, to refrain from killing, to refrain from stealing, to refrain from lying, to refrain from abusive sexuality or intoxicants. And those are part of every single Buddhist tradition.
Other moral tenets are described in the Noble Eightfold Path. The eight principles are right understanding, right speech, right action or conduct, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, right meditation. Vipassana teacher Jack Kornfield explains two of them here.
Right livelihood says that how we work is an integral part of our spiritual development. If we create suffering through our work, by selling armaments or dealing drugs or doing any other livelihood that causes harm to others, it's impossible for us to develop spiritually. It's very hard to sit in meditation after a day of selling weapons. On the other hand, it also says that our livelihood can be a source of awakening. Whatever job we have, whether it is a plumber or a nurse, a farmer or a teacher, we can do that job with respect, with mindfulness, developing a sense of wakefulness and loving kindness for each person that we encounter in our day of work, and in that way we can turn it into our spiritual practice. Right speech is also central to spiritual practice. Right speech is defined first as the absence of lying, of gossip, of slander. All of the speech that causes harm to others also harms our spiritual development. Further, right speech is the direct cultivation of speech that brings harmony, that brings concord, that brings awakening to people.
Buddhist morality is seen as an outgrowth of the understanding gained through the practice of meditation.
We discover through awareness that when we do not treat others kindly and skillfully, it not only causes suffering to them, it causes suffering to ourselves. We see this more and more clearly with our own mindfulness. So there arises in practice a natural virtue, a natural kindness, a natural integrity that comes when our eyes are open. This is the other level that is spoken of. We can come to a certain point where it is not a question of trying to do good or trying to avoid lying or harming another person. We sense ourselves to be so interconnected with others that the idea of good and bad makes no sense on this level.
The code of right living that guides Buddhist actions does not always produce conduct that contributes to harmony and understanding. Practice does not necessarily make perfect. This is true of teachers as well as students. In the last decade or so, there have been several cases of abuse of power among Buddhist teachers and masters, both Asian and American. These incidents have prompted a critical look at ethics, practices, and the structure of the teacher-student relationship.
Every place the same kind of corruption, sex and money and power. Even in Japan, you know, Buddhism in Japan has the same kind of things, money and sex and power. Well, sex, it's not so much. I mean, well, sex is not like here in the United States.
Scandals mark the end of a kind of age of innocence for many Buddhist communities. Sexual improprieties, substance abuse, and financial wrongdoing resulted in dismissals, restructuring, and much re-evaluation of Sangha administration and accountability.
There is, of course, a history now in American Buddhism of sexual abuse and sexual misconduct in Buddhist centers, in Zen centers, and in some of the other centers too, Tibetan Buddhist centers, and a tiny bit in Theravada centers. They seem to have had less of that misconduct. And I think the reason that they had less misconduct was that Theravada Buddhism, or Vipassana, was brought to this country by Westerners. It was not brought by Asian masters.
Sandy Boucher is the author of Turning the Wheel, A History of Women in Buddhism.
Because some of the abuse, I think, has come about because you have these men who were trained in an Asian setting, who were trained in an all-male setting, usually, and they come to a totally different culture. They're quite, I would think, in some sense, confused about what the rules are, and they're presented with all these women, and they sometimes act in ways which are not appropriate. That's one of the explanations for why this has happened. You could talk about hierarchy within Buddhist centers as being a problem.
While most of the initial cases of abuse involved Asian masters, increasingly their chosen American successors, sometimes called Dharma heirs, are under criticism.
I think there was a period of time in which people were, you know, the whole mystification of Buddhism. They were mystified by these Asian teachers, and they thought they were enlightened beings. Some of them indeed were, I suppose. I don't know how you define that, but they were. And therefore, if they were enlightened beings, everything they did was okay, even though our common sense told us it wasn't.
American Buddhism is growing up and learning to develop its own set of guidelines. It must be understood that Buddhism in this country is still in a state of infancy, so to speak. In other cultures where Buddhism has taken root, it took about 500 years of evolution before becoming firmly established.
We know that when our common sense tells us that something is not proper behavior, at least we ought to discuss it with everyone present, including the teacher, and discern whether what is going on is appropriate or not. And a number of people are trying to work out guidelines which will be agreed to by whole teachers and communities. And in fact, some Buddhist communities have already done that. When you have a strictly hierarchical system, which is what the Asian Buddhist masters brought with them, and which may work fine in an Asian society, you're restricting information a great deal. People talk about the model of the dysfunctional family within Buddhist centers, in which the participants act as the children in a dysfunctional family, and they protect the teacher or the father, even though they can see that he's doing something wrong.
Buddhism shares important language, goals, and techniques with the field of psychotherapy and often attracts people seeking similar kinds of healing. As with most analysis of Buddhism, there are differing opinions about Buddhism's relationship to psychology. Jack Kornfield is both a Buddhist teacher and psychotherapist.
The purpose of both Western psychology and Buddhist psychology is to help alleviate human suffering and to assist us to understand the difficulties of our life and transform them into
compassion and wisdom. They have a lot in common, and they have a great deal to offer one another. Western psychology has developed many special techniques for dealing with the kinds of wounds of our particular society, the alienation, the level of addiction, the breakdown of family, and so forth that many people experience. Eastern psychology also directly approaches these from a different route than the one-to-one contact of therapy. Instead, it works through transformative practices of the heart and mind, cultivating loving kindness, practices to develop the heart of compassion, practices that develop a sense of balance and equilibrium in the face of what is called the 10,000 joys and the 10,000 sorrows of life. And so what we're asked to do in Buddhist practice is not to change the nature of life, but to find the capacity of heart and mind to enter into it with loving kindness and understanding, to accept what Zorba the Greek called the whole catastrophe, and in accepting it, to transform it in our hearts to something that's beautiful or of value.
Ryo Imamura teaches a course called Buddhism and Psychotherapy.
There's a lot of Western psychologists who think of Buddhism as another form of psychotherapy, which is of great interest in the West, is seen with a great deal of surprise and humor from the East, that these broad assumptions can be made so easily. To categorize or minimize the whole tradition of another people into just a discipline here, an academic discipline. We have to look at the history and the development, especially of psychology in the West, which emerges from a scientific, or shall we say, pseudo-scientific premise, and also from a medical assumption that there is such a thing as normal and abnormal health. And so in our Western tradition, we're very almost obsessed with defining things and categorizing, trying to lay scientific basis or put forth criteria so that we can measure these things and give people labels and diagnoses. And so basically, psychotherapy still is, to a large extent, bringing people from abnormal to normal behavior. Happiness is defined as the ability to love and to work. Very, I guess, mundane, though important, goals in life. And as long as people are functioning, working 40 hours a week, they have a family or relationships, whatever, they're considered healthy. And so neuroses or even psychoses are when we're dysfunctional, cannot perform as normal, healthy human beings. But then under healthy is seen everyone in the Pentagon. You know, people who I think have very limited, one-sided view of human life and what human capabilities are. And yet this all falls under normalcy. The basic foundation of Western psychotherapy is making people normal, which is quite a political issue. When you start talking about people of color, people from lower economic classes, women, gay people, and so on, who don't necessarily share the same assumptions, the same goals in life, then they are considered to be abnormal. Now, Buddhism has no real interest and people being normal in the sense. There's already the premise that we are all basically unenlightened, therefore blind, therefore stunted in our growth, limited, not functioning fully as human beings. So to be human is to be, if you want to use a psychological term, neurotic, not functioning in a full, healthy manner. And so Buddhism, with that assumption, that assumes that all of us need so-called treatment or can use it, a treatment or better, a way of life that shows us how to open our eyes and to become fully human, to enjoy the great beauty and magic in this world that we have. It's not the same goal as psychotherapy. ¶¶
Paula Green is a Buddhist and a psychotherapist.
I find that there's a certain kind of emotional self-knowing that comes best in the psychotherapy process, where people have a chance to feel their emotions, that the meditation process is one in which, in Vipassana, one is taught to be aware of everything that is coming up emotionally and mentally, but not to dwell on it.
Buddhist scholar Stephen Rockefeller.
It is important to keep in mind that, speaking in general terms, therapy and meditation accomplish different things. While it is true that some forms of meditation may help some people in connection with the problems for which psychotherapy has been designed, as a general rule, meditation should not be viewed by Westerners as a substitute for psychotherapy when it is needed in the context of the process of self-realization.
Psychotherapy, social activism, conflict resolution, these are just a few of the areas where Buddhism is playing a significant role. Journalist Scoop Nisker has practiced Buddhism for over 20 years.
The United States is the melting pot, and it's very obvious to me that Buddhism is going to also melt in the United States. So we're going to have a little bit of Tibetan Buddhism, a little bit of Burmese Buddhism, a little bit of Japanese Buddhism, a little bit of Indian Buddhism, and they're all going to... I mean, there'll be some centers that will be pure Indian Buddhism, but there will be a lot of people who have a little bit of this and a little bit of that, and it's all going to mix with American kind of, you know, social activism and nature, love of nature, and a little bit of Native American spirituality, and it's going to come out a different creature.
Instead of a melting pot, we should be having a salad bowl. While the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution that you have can be our dressing, the salad dressing, which will lace all the ingredients.
Richard Pa'u is a Burmese Buddhist who now lives in Hawaii. He's the founder of the Hawaiian Association of International Buddhists, an ecumenical group.
Some will be lettuce, some will be tomatoes, some will be potatoes, but it does not matter, because each can retain its own taste. At the same time, it will be laced with that American constitutional freedom and individual rights.
Whether it's a salad bowl or a melting pot, the vessel containing American Buddhism is large and unique. We end this look at Buddhism in the United States with an example of the singular flavor of one expression of American Buddhism: a birthday party for the Buddha at Green Gulch Zen Center.
And animals stop eating one another to take a look, and people stop killing one another to take a look, and noxious creatures and ghosts stop haunting one another to take a look. They all looked and wept with unconsidered joy. Give up his kingdom to be a light, removing darkness from all beings, and he will be a boat to carry the beings up from the ocean of suffering, overspread with the foam of disease and the waves of old age and the flood of death, and the world will drink of the stream of his law to slake the ageless thirst born of affliction.
Gently down the stream.
Well, we've come to the end of this now. This is Richard Gere wishing you all supreme happiness and the causes of future happiness. Walk on.
East Meets West was produced by Pamela Michael and Sue Supriano and written by Pamela Michael. Interviews were by Sue Supriano. Our engineer for this program was Lynn Beidel. The production was funded in part by the California Council for the Humanities, the Tides Foundation, the Numata Center for Buddhist Translation and Research, Buddhist Churches of America, Richard Gere, Stephen Rockefeller, Virginia Warner, Pamela Krasny, and Brian Gibson. Special thanks to the Institute of Buddhist Studies, KPFA Radio, David Gans, and especially to Richard Gere for his narration and support. For information about this program, write the Buddhist Radio Project, 1602 Delaware Street, Berkeley, California, 94703.